Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, American company Boeing, the world's biggest manufacturer of airplanes, hopes its best-selling Boeing 737 MAX will soon return to the skies. That hope seems unlikely. Airline companies and flight safety officials around the world ordered the 737 MAX grounded after two of the planes crashed. On Wednesday, new information was released about the minutes leading up to the crash of a Lion Air passenger jet last October. The jet came down in the Java Sea shortly after leaving Jakarta, Indonesia's capital. The Reuters news agency says the new information appears to show the plane had a serious flaw. Experts believe the plane's automated system may have forced the nose of the aircraft downward. They said this appears to have caused both the Lion Air crash and the crash of an Ethiopian Airlines jet on March 10th. The two crashes killed 346 people. The automated system attempts to prevent the plane from stalling on takeoff. Flight safety experts say neither crash investigation is complete. They add that actions of crew members and their training will also be looked at closely. At Boeing's headquarters in Chicago, Illinois, officials have promised to quickly release a new version of computer software for the 737 MAX. However, officials in Europe and Canada will want to test it themselves instead of depending only on U.S. approval. Investigators continue to examine the black box data recorder from the most recent crash. Reuters has learned that the black box on the Lion Air flight showed the captain tried to get information from a 737 MAX handbook as he lost control of the plane. For 9 minutes, the jet warned pilots it was in a stall and pushed the nose down, the report showed. The captain fought to climb, but the automated system continued to push the nose down. Investigators examining the Indonesian crash want to know how and why a computer ordered the plane to dive. They believe it was because of a sensor that did not work correctly. They also want to know if pilots had enough training to control the jet. It is like a test where there are 100 questions and when the time is up, you have only answered 75, said someone with knowledge of the cockpit recording. So you panic.
Boeing has said there is a documented way for dealing with the problem. It also said the pilot and co-pilot are supposed to understand the process. A different crew on the same plane the night before had the same problem, but solved it after running through 3 checklists. Bloomberg reported that the crew members got help from an off-duty pilot who was on the same flight. The crew members apparently did not explain the problem or its solution to the next crew, investigators found. Those findings were released in November. Boeing must wait for several investigations before the 737 MAX can return to the sky. In the past, Europe and Canada would have accepted the findings of the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA. Now, they will seek their own answers.
For years, the Italian city of Venice has been struggling with a few concerns. Piazza San Marco, also known as St. Mark's Square, is often flooded. Venice's waterways require repairs. But by far, the biggest problem is the growing number of visitors to the city. So, city officials have decided to require all visitors to pay a fee to enter Venice. The money will help to pay for cleaning and other services that help to keep the city beautiful. Overnight tourists already pay a tax that is added to the cost of their hotel stay. The new fee will be required of tourists who come to the city for a few hours or for one day. Venice's mayor, Luigi Brugnaro, explained the decision to international media during a visit to Rome last week. The mayor said that officials want to defend the city for those who live there. Venice is a marvel of the world, and only in this way can it be saved, he added. Brugnaro added that the fee process will be experimental at first. A one-day visit will cost about $7. City officials have yet to decide when the fee collection will begin. The money will be collected by transport companies that bring the tourists to Venice. The city will set up cameras for individuals arriving in private cars, and there will be fines for those who do not pay the fee. Students, some workers, and children under the age of 6 will not have to pay. Naturally, anyone born or living in Venice is exempt. In January 2020, the cost of the visitation fee will not be fixed. It will instead be based on how many tourists are visiting Venice on a given day. City fathers hope this will prevent the overcrowding that often comes with large numbers of tourists. Some people living in Venice say they do not believe the fee plan will work. Lawyer Roberta Pierabon said it will be impossible to collect the money from everyone who visits the city. Visitors arrive from all sides, she said. She noted that Venice is an island and you reach it on water. She does not believe tourists can be controlled and added that she disapproved of the plan. Other Venetians like the idea. They say it will make tourism less aggressive. Michele Tessari often works with tourists on transport. He said Venetians would like a more sophisticated form of tourism. They want fewer people who come into the city for eat-and-run tourism, and the entrance fee will help. Tessari says locals no longer want to see tourists eating on the bridges of Venice. Venetians love their city and know it will never stop appealing to visitors. Venice is so special, they say, that it belongs to the whole of humanity. I'm Jill Robbins.
A new study suggests the Apple Watch was able to identify abnormal heart rates that could be linked to a serious heart condition. More than 400,000 Apple Watch users volunteered for the study. It was a project of researchers at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Apple, the American technology company, provided money for the study. Results were recently presented at a major conference on heart health in New Orleans, Louisiana. The researchers looked for signs of atrial fibrillation, the most common form of irregular heartbeat. The condition, also called AFib, results from the abnormal firing of electrical signals in the upper chambers of the heart. Some people with atrial fibrillation feel changes in their heartbeat, while others do not. Because of this, many people do not know they have the condition. People with untreated AFib are about 5 times more likely to suffer a stroke. In the United States, AFib causes an estimated 130,000 deaths and 750,000 hospitalizations each year. People taking part in the study wore the Apple Watch for extended periods during 2017 and 2018. The devices contain an app that continuously gathers information without users having to do anything. It uses the watch's light sensor technology to measure blood flow. The system is designed to identify changes that might show an irregular heartbeat. The researchers said that out of those taking part, about 2,000 subjects received a warning from the device that they might have a problem. Those individuals were then asked to contact a doctor, who decided whether they should receive a patch to more closely watch for a possible irregular heartbeat. The patch uses electrocardiography, or ECG, technology. Electrocardiography is the process of measuring and recording electrical signals in the heart. The study found that about 84% of the time, those who received warnings of irregular heartbeat activity were found to be experiencing AFib at the time. Of those who received warnings and followed up by using an ECG patch, 1/3 were found later to have AFib. Overall, about 57% of those taking part in the study sought some kind of medical attention, researchers said. Lloyd Miner is head of Stanford's School of Medicine. In a statement, he said the results show great promise in using technology to create more predictive and preventive health care. Dr. Miner added that AFib is just one example of a condition devices can help identify in the future. This study opens the door to further research into wearable technologies and how they might be used to prevent disease before it strikes, he said. But some health researchers warned against making any general judgments based on the Apple-financed study. They have called for much more research to measure the effectiveness of wearable devices to identify signs of disease. Richard Kovacs is with the American College of Cardiology. He was not involved with the study. Dr. Kovacs told the Associated Press that despite the results, the Apple Watch system is not perfect. He noted that since the study did not have a comparison group getting regular ECG measurements, there is no way of knowing if the device missed heartbeat problems. This could give users a false sense of security, he said. Other experts agreed that more studies are needed before similar device-based health observation systems are widely recommended. I would not advise this to the overall general population, said Valentin Fuster, director of New York's Mount Sinai Heart System and a former American Heart Association president. He said he would rather see such systems tested in people with additional health risks, such as older adults with high blood pressure. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. President James Garfield was shot and seriously wounded in the summer of 1881. The man who shot him said he supported the political group that supported Vice President Chester Arthur. The gunman was found to be insane, but some people were ready to believe the worst about Vice President Arthur. They knew that many of the Vice President's political allies disliked President Garfield. They thought the Vice President might have helped the gunman in some way. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell what happened after President Garfield was shot.
For a time, it seemed the president might get better. But the bullet wound became infected. He died of the infection 2 months after he was shot. Vice President Arthur took the oath of office a few hours after the president's death. Chester Arthur had been a successful lawyer. He had worked in politics for a number of years, but he had never before held an elected office. Many Americans questioned his ability to serve in the White House. One person put it this way: Chet Arthur, President of the United States? Good God!
Almost everyone feared Arthur would be a tool of a Republican Party leader in New York, Roscoe Conkling. They were sure Conkling would be the real power in Arthur's administration. They were wrong. Chester Arthur surprised everyone. He broke all his ties with the Conkling political machine. He remained independent of any party group. Arthur asked Garfield's cabinet to resign. He chose new men for all but one department.
In his first message to Congress, President Arthur asked for changes in the way government jobs were filled. He proposed a new civil service system that would let ability, not politics, decide who got government jobs. Republican Party leaders opposed these proposals. The civil service system would stop them from giving federal jobs to their supporters. It would destroy much of their power. These Republican leaders controlled Congress. They refused to act on the civil service proposals.
Civil service reform, however, was an important issue. President Garfield had been assassinated by a man who believed he should have gotten a government job because of his politics. Also, new cases of dishonesty had been discovered in the Post Office Department. The public began to demand laws to clean up the civil service. In 1882, a new Congress was elected. The new Congress was controlled by the Democratic Party. President Arthur again appealed for civil service reform. This time, he got results. The new Congress passed a civil service bill that required 10% of all federal jobs to be filled through competitive examinations. This 10% included half the officials in the Post Office Department. It included most workers at federal customs houses. The bill also said it was illegal for politicians to ask government employees for campaign money, and it set up a civil service committee to enforce the new law.
President Arthur also found himself faced with an unusual problem. The government was earning more money than it needed. Most of the money came from tariffs, taxes on imports. Each year, tariffs brought in $100 million more than the government needed. The import taxes had been set high to protect American industries from foreign competition. President Arthur wanted to reduce the tariffs. Congress wanted to keep them high. Industrial leaders wanted to keep them high, too. They did not want to compete with low-priced foreign products.
Congress saw no problem with the extra money brought in by high tariffs. It found many ways to spend it. For example, Congress raised payments to soldiers who had fought in the Civil War during the 1860s. It also approved money to build roads, bridges, and waterways throughout the country. Many of these things were not needed. They were approved for political purposes. They put government money into the home areas of powerful congressmen. In 1882, Congress passed the Rivers and Harbors Bill. The bill would cost almost $19 million. President Arthur vetoed the bill. He said it would waste too much money, but Congress passed the bill into law over his veto.
Next, President Arthur urged Congress to form a committee to find a way to reduce tariffs. Congress formed the committee. The committee proposed that tariffs be reduced by 20%. But Congress did not consider the proposal when it began debating a new tariff bill. President Arthur was more successful in getting Congress to reduce the public debt. During his term, the debt was cut by more than $400 million.
Chester Arthur's efforts for honest government and lower taxes won him much support among the people. But he could not win the support of his Republican Party. Arthur wanted to serve another 4 years in the White House. His name was put before the Republican nominating convention in 1884. The name of Senator James Blaine of Maine also was put before the convention. On the first ballot, Blaine received 334 votes. Arthur got only 278. 3 ballots later, Blaine won the presidential nomination. However, many Republicans refused to support Blaine. They accused him of being dishonest. They said he was controlled by powerful politicians.
The Democratic Party chose New York Governor Grover Cleveland as its presidential candidate. Like Chester Arthur at the national level, Grover Cleveland was known for fighting dishonesty in government at the local level. He began as mayor of the city of Buffalo, New York. He cleaned up the city government and saved the taxpayers much money. Next, he was elected governor of New York State. There, too, he helped end dishonesty in government. Cleveland refused to give jobs to Democrats because of their political ties. Instead, he filled state jobs with men of ability. This early success helped him win the Democratic presidential nomination.
The campaign of 1884 between Republican Blaine and Democrat Cleveland was one of the most bitter in American political history. A group of Republicans who opposed Blaine published letters to prove he was dishonest. Blaine had written the letters several years earlier during a shameful incident concerning the sale of railroad stock. Now he was forced to defend himself against those old charges.
Blaine's supporters fought back by discovering a scandal in Cleveland's past. Grover Cleveland had never married, but more than 10 years earlier, he had been involved with a young woman. The woman gave birth to a boy. Cleveland was not sure the boy was his son, but he accepted responsibility for the child. He sent money to help care for him. A Republican newspaper published the story. Soon, Republican crowds were shouting a joke about it. "Ma! Ma, where's my pa?" "Gone to the White House. Ha, ha, ha."
Both candidates campaigned hard. It was clear to everyone that the vote would be close. Election day was cold and rainy. Early results showed the two candidates with almost the same number of electoral votes. The winner would be the one who captured a majority of the popular votes in New York State. That candidate would then get all of New York's electoral votes. It was not until 3 days after the voting that election officials announced Cleveland had won. His victory set off wild celebrations among Democrats across the country. Grover Cleveland really was going to the White House. Ha, ha, ha. His election would bring some important changes to the country.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.